I, Charles IV, or is it the third? Bloody
pain. We will strive for the detoxification of the
Let me put it to you.
Can't grow concrete.
Yes, you
if
can.
You win by one, oh, you've won.
The phone went over the side of the
phone. It is time to draw it up.
I just think everyone should be sure.
What the fuck is going on?
Hello, I'm Pete Sinclair. Welcome to Mark Steele's podcast, where each week we ask the question, what the fuck is going on? And this week, as the co-writer and co-producer, I thought I'd let you know what the fuck is going on with Mark. He's finished the treatment for his throat cancer, and the good news is that it all seems to be going to plan. Unfortunately, part of the plan is that the side effects of the radio and chemotherapy do tend to knock you for six, which means at the moment, Mark has temporarily lost his voice. Not ideal for recording a podcast. Next week, we'll be copying Have I Got News For You and having a guest host, and we might do that for a couple of weeks until Mark gets his voice back. But for this week, here's another chance to listen to our most downloaded episode of all time. This is Mark doing an extended interview with presenter James O'Brien. Enjoy.
Now, so many times I have said that if anybody wants to work out what the fuck is going on, you need expert advice. I've never really meant it. I've sort of been complimenting people and that, and then on comes someone who hasn't got a clue like me. But for the first time, I can honestly say I have the expert, Mr. James O'Brien. Not only do you know what the fuck is going on, but you spend all day listening to people who clearly have got less clue even than I have what the fuck is going on, and yet think they do know what the fuck is going on.
There is a relationship between the pungency of opinion and the depth of knowledge that I like to navigate.
Well, that, yeah, you have put what I've just said in proper English prose. That has been like Jonathan Swift found some betting slip and turned it into a beautiful poem. Oh. The depth of the pungency of the...
The pungency of the opinion is a relationship with the depth of the knowledge, I think. They're not all like that. You see, you're doing this thing. I have to immediately defend the huge majority of my callers. It's only the ones that go viral, the ones that get clipped up, are the ones that are a bit more like a spectator sport, a bit more gladiatorial. So it is the slayings that go viral. But a lot of the time, it's just a very illuminating and enlightening job.
It is very illuminating. I think, obviously, for comedic purposes, it's easier to say that people listen to what this ridiculous person said. But I do find, I don't know, maybe it's an age thing. There's very rarely that I listen to someone now and I think you are just an idiot. And, there is no point at which we might connect. Most of the time when that happens, it's because I'm listening to someone from the front bench of the British government.
It's quite the era, isn't it? For not just the front bench, but there's all the other benches as well. Jonathan Gullis in the House of Commons yesterday was, I think, worse than anyone who's got through to me in the last 10 years, just in terms of boneheadedness and unpleasantness. It used to be radio phone-in programs where you'd get the really vicious, vitriolic ignorance. But now, as you say, you've got the government providing it for free.
Do you think they compete? Do you think they sort of sit there before I go, right, I've got to beat Gullis. Someone will write now, I've got to beat Gullis.
Gullis and Anderson.
Oh, Anderson's marvellous, isn't he? Yeah.
They compare, and then there's a bloke called Brendan something, double-barreled, who seems to be like the kind of, remember Craig in Bros? He seems to be like the third, slightly eclipsed member of the triumvirate, while all the twins are getting all the attention. Tweedledum and Tweedledummer are getting all the attention. But I wouldn't be surprised if they keep tabs on each other's clip count or media bookings, and they think, crikey, I better be slightly viler.
Yeah,
today.
I suppose so. Yeah, no, they outdo each other. I'm going to stand up in the Commons and say, do you know that Romanians are 98% insect? Do you know what? Under the EU, the Bulgarians could have come here and brought a mountain each. That's what they could have brought. And we ain't got room. I'm my constituency. Okay. If we had another range of mountains, we wouldn't have, we'd have to knock down a post office. It's not fair.
There's no room for our own mountains.
No mountains. We ain't got any mountains. I live in Grays Thurrock. There's no mountains at all. And they were allowed to bring their own whole range. Peru, they've got the Andes. I've got half of them. Yeah. Yeah, they will. Give it by, what do you reckon? By about October?
Well, we've got billions of people coming here now, according to Suella Braverman. I literally used the word billion in a Daily Mail article. Actually, the B word. Actual billion. Incredible. So, you know, all bets are off. A billion mountain.
I wonder what you would have to do to get a billion people here. I wonder if you've got, like, every fleet of aircraft, all holidays around the world were cancelled, and they just, all airlines around the world, American Airlines, Indian, everyone, was just Aeroflot the lot, just took people, packed their planes full of people. I don't want to go. I live it. No, we've got to. It's the new rule. And we've got to see. It's like a modern record breakers. We're going to see if we can get a billion people. I wonder if it would be possible within 10 years.
Shoulder to shoulder. I don't know. You'd need a worldwide effort. And you're right, it would. You'd have the latter-day Roy Castle there counting. And they used to see how many people they could get in a mini or something like that.
Except that loads of them would have died by the time you got the last. Oh, no, it doesn't count. We've got to get another 700 from Qatar.
A billion people. If we don't do this, a billion people could be making their way here by tea time. It's incredible.
Marvelous. It's very important to say, because because what I find with your, when I'm listening to your program, my son, incidentally, is an absolute devotee.
Oh, legend.
And
I give him my best.
He and I think that it feels that, like, you are trying to sort of win people round to start with, until they, you know, unless they go completely off the edge.
I am now. I didn't used to. I kind of used to be, I think, quite aggressive. Winning the argument, whether you were right or wrong. Do you see what I mean? So the skills that you use, for me, it's quite a public school thing. I see it a lot in Johnson and Cameron and people like that, where, you know, we were doing debates when we were teenagers, and you'd sometimes debate the opposite of what you actually believe, because it was the greater intellectual challenge. And I'd sort of spent my life like that without realizing that it wasn't entirely authentic. So yeah, I used to just revel in the destruction, in the win. But then a few years ago, things sort of started changing a bit for me. I had quite a lot of therapy and realized that it's not a win. Even if you leave someone in a puddle of their own tears on the floor, you haven't changed a single mind. You haven't won an argument if the person that you're... So I tend to be a lot less combative now, a lot more sparing. As you say, occasionally someone will come along who needs a bit of a slap. But generally, it's a better radio as well. I worried for a while that I was sort of therapizing myself out of a job, because you think this is what the public want. They want the gladiator. They want the public executions. They want the sort of slanging matches and the... Because that's how the genre has always operated, really, usually with right-wing people doing it. So I kind of had a liberal approach, but the tactics of a traditional radio phone-in host. But it's worked really well. Actually, you learn more from people as well, and you give them more rope, so that if they are going to use it ultimately to you know, metaphorically hang themselves, then there's even more of it, if the politer you've been. So it is, yeah. What I want is the emails I get from people who say that, you know, I was in the EDL when I started listening to your show. I don't get these every day. I wouldn't want to pretend that. But I do get lovely emails from people and messages, and people stop me in the street and say, you've changed the way that I look at things. And I don't think I was doing that when I was smashing people over the head with my opinions.
Well, that's fascinating, because as someone, you know, I was in a far-left group and everything, sort of gently winning people round was never normally the method, really.
No, it's a good parallel, actually, because that kind of angry, accusatory tone that you often get on the hard left, it is not really conducive to recruitment, is it? On a gentle level,
I sort of, you know, I also have sympathy for where they're coming from, sort of, yes, maybe in a way. Course. But I was doing a little tryout show. Sometimes comics always do little shows, you know, when you're sort of working out your material. There's a lovely place in Brighton that I always do, that's above a heavy metal pub, and there's about 60 seats there. It's a lovely little place. And someone came along, and it was during a period when I think it was the time when someone in the Labour right. I mean, Smith had challenged Corbyn or something. And this person came along and they were giving leaflets out. And the guy who ran the venue, he said, I'll be honest with you, I'm in the Labour Party and I'm going to vote for Owen Smith. And this woman who was giving the leaflets out just screamed for about 5 minutes. You fucking idiot. You don't know what she fucking... How can you? You fucking... After about five... And when she finished, I just said, do you think that won him round? And to her credit, she...
Tying him up.
she did sort of go, oh, no, no, yeah, yeah. It's just... But, you know, but the reason that upset me so much, that little incident, is because I think 30 years, that would have been me. Definitely, right. You know, if we're talking about therapy, we hate what we see in ourselves, don't we? I think that would have been me. And then, I mean, it's like in a relationship, you know, you sort of, you shout some really witty retort to your partner and you think, oh, I hope the neighbours heard that through the wall. Because that was fucking banging.
It's a zinger.
But, you know, but then all your furniture disappears and you never see them again.
But the anger's real. It's just misdirected, I think. I got that a lot when I still do really with Jeremy Corbyn supporters. And I began wondering about a year ago whether I'd allowed my own opinions of him to be coloured by his foot soldiers, because they're so rude and unpleasant on social media, so aggressive and so dismissive of anybody who isn't immediately complete. I wonder whether he's actually reaped a little bit that he doesn't deserve, because he's kind of associated with some of the aggression and I would say obnoxiousness of some of his most committed supporters.
Ooh, now I agree with you there, because I've been the recipient, probably nowhere near as much as you have, but I get that, and I've not even said anything against him, nothing.
No,
really.
You don't have to.
And then I got this week, someone just called me a Blairite cunt.
Oh, fantastic.
And I just thought, right, well, all right, I'll take the second half of that, but really? I don't know. Really? And yeah, and then I saw Jeremy Corbyn doing an interview this week after he was suspended from the Labour Party. And it was a bit like, I thought, oh, I forgot how you were actually very measured and you were sort of very keen to not make it personal. I thought, I forgot you actually, you know, I personally think he is a very, very lovely, sweet, well-meaning bloke. I think that's, you know, that's a very base level, but that clearly is a guy. And you even forget that. And I do agree. I've definitely been... My impression of him has definitely been, I don't know why, but I don't know about you, James, but when someone calls you a Blairite cunt, it tends you not to warm to the...
No, but he wouldn't, would he? I've only met him very, very briefly. I never got the chance to interview him, but he wouldn't do that. And I suppose, you know, that refusal or failure to take responsibility for some of the nasty stuff that was going on under his leadership, some of it really, really nasty, much worse than you and I being abused as centrist melts, or I'm not going to say the C word, it'll get clipped up and it'll haunt me for the rest of my career. He could probably have done more to disassociate himself from it. But if he was here, he'd probably say, why should I? I don't endorse it. So why should I have to disassociate myself from it? But it didn't help. It just, you say that name and I don't think of him in his amenable mode. I think of the sort of insults that you've just shared, and they didn't come from him, did they? But they came.
No. They would. They never would. No, he was. No. He was almost infuriatingly sort of measured and.
Except when he's not, he does get a bit petulant. There was a clip this week. Someone was just trying to ask him about. See, I think he's great when he's in charge. When he's, you know, here we are. Someone said to me, he's never happier than when he's photocopying leaflets and putting them through letterboxes and then stopping for a chat with people about whatever's on the leaflet. But don't veer off the leaflet. Don't start asking him about how he feels about being suspended or how he feels about not being out. So there was a Sky News journalist this week who just, you know, he's a prominent politician. He's headline news again this week. So she sees him in Westminster, sticks a microphone in his face. And there's just that, there's a thin, I don't know, he sometimes veers into petulance that can look quite unpleasant, especially he's quite a big lad, I think. And she was quite a small woman and he leant in very close to the camera. So he's not quite the cuddly creation of
it must
some...
be so hard though, James. I don't want to be sort of like I feel sorry for politicians or anything, but I do on some occasions. I think if you're sort of especially if you're prominent and you've got a camera on you, sort of like everything you do, and you've only once got to lean into someone and go, "Oh, that's come on, true, mate." Especially if someone's been calling you all sorts of horrible names.
Yeah,
oh,
that's
come on,
true.
That's no good. And that, I'm just raising my arm there, would be enough to go, "Look at this.
Yeah,
he's worse than Rommel." Me.
Yes, no, it's a very good point. And that little, I think that's why they tried to bring in legislation, didn't they, around Parliament Green that would have prevented people. Steve Bray's always there fighting the good fight. But yeah, I mean, if you're getting targeted by someone with a loud hailer, for example, every single day, every time you cross his path, I think you're very fair to suggest that patience may run out in a way that wouldn't be characteristic in normal circumstances.
Yes. All right. Well, that's this now will be more evidence that I am the BC person. And then sometimes they go, "Oh, I see you can't even be bothered to reply." They go,
"Yeah, yeah." There's a weird place on Twitter where you do reach an almost zen-like pick and choose mode. I remember in my early days on it, I'd get all flipping heartbeat and I'm like, "How dare you? I'm going to challenge that." And from someone whose account was a packet of cigarettes or something was their avatar, and there's no name on there or anything, and you'd sort of think, "What am I doing?" But then there comes a point where there's just so much of it that you really can just zone in and zone out and
I want to meet the packets of cigarettes first. I've been campaigning for the reintroduction of cigarettes as a bona fide method of sponsorship for the snooker, and you go on about fucking Brexit.
It could be that. It could be something like that. But no, you haven't replied. What do you expect? So someone comes along and calls you something vile, and then, I don't know, my favourites are probably the people who boast about being blocked. So someone comes along and says, you know, let's say for the sake of argument, they say something horrible about your mum. So you just go, "All right, I'll block you then." And then 6 months later, you're looking at a profile and it says, "Proudly blocked by James O'Brien and Mark Steele and Owen Jones," or whatever it is. And you think, when did this person say, you're the bloke who said that thing about my mum. Of course I blocked you. What do you expect? It's not because the power of your arguments was so immense that I had to scurry into my hidey hole. And it's you made a shit joke about my mum, you know?
Yeah, I see you didn't reply to my point about your mum.
Yes.
All the dustmen who work for Ilford Council and the shenanigans you got up to with them.
And I conclude, therefore. It's true, isn't it? It's funny, except when it isn't.
So what do you... give us an example, if you can, sorry to put you on the spot, of, say, someone who has... obviously, the EDL person is extreme, but someone who might have changed over the course of a call. Because, you know, I have heard those on your show.
The course of the call is hard. I mean, you hope that you're sort of scattering seeds around the place, and some of them will land on stony ground. So it's as much about the listener as the caller. One I always think of, and it wasn't fireworks or pistols at dawn, but it was so complete, really, the turnaround. And it began from a position of such certainty. And it was just someone ringing in to explain to me why political correctness is actually a very bad thing.
Right.
And why I should, you know, and it wasn't aggressive. I'll tell you what it was. I can actually remember the details, which is increasingly rare as the years pass. But it was, he had a school uniform shop. He was a school uniform supplier. And it was one of those stories about they weren't going to have boys and girls sections at John Lewis anymore. They were just going to have children's sections. Or so, you know, those sort of stories along. And there's rarely much to them. But if you frame the headline right, you can claim that it's a, you know, an assault upon our children. And this bloke, quite understandably, because it's his livelihood, had taken the bait, and he rang in to tell me why it was awful and couldn't, because it essentially day to day your customers are going to be exactly the same and the stuff that you're selling is exactly the same. All that's changed potentially is a bit of vocabulary. So there's no actual meaningful change to your life. It's just you feel like something has been taken away. And in order to make you feel like something has been taken away, They have called it political correctness.
Yeah,
and we
yeah.
did the old, sort of cod Socratic dialogue where I kept asking him what he meant by things. And it ended with him saying, I suppose political correctness just means having good manners, really, doesn't it? And I said, and what's wrong with that? And it was a lovely moment where I mean, I know there are ridiculous examples from the 80s of councils doing crazy, but that wasn't what he was cross about. He was cross about something relatively innocuous because it was as if the phrase, the actual words, it's woke now, so we must be going back 4 or 5 years, but the words become a magnifying glass. So you have an emotional reaction to something, which is probably exaggerated because that's the nature of tabloid style journalism. Get the biggest emotional response you can, whatever the actual facts are. So you've already responded emotionally to it. And somehow these catchphrases, these watchwords, become magnifying glasses. So he because it was political correctness, it's like you start off with a glimmer of irritation at something that has been done. Then you add the catalyst of vocabulary. You add the words that are now enraging, the word woke, the words political. And suddenly his rage or his unhappiness, his disapproval had been hugely increased. And it's nice sometimes to just turn the dial back down again and take him back to where he really should have been, which is where it seems a bit daft to be not saying boys and girls clothes anymore, but it's probably not part of some massive secret conspiracy.
Yes, that started in Venezuela. I know, yes, if you sort
exactly.
of...
exactly. What the fuck is going on?
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.
I mean, sometimes we should responding in kind and that. Say, right, there we are, the Elizabeth line, named after late Majesty. Maybe we should go, we have to call it after the late Queen, do we? It's political correctness gone mad. Why can't it just be the West Reading to East London line? But, oh, no, the woke brigade.
That's funny, isn't it? I love that idea of doing it a bit like, was it John Thompson used to do with Bernard Wright on? That complete subversion of what you're expecting to happen, and yet suddenly go, hang on a minute, that's what the other lot do all the time.
Why should it? Why should things get named after all the things that are named after?
She's got enough named after. No one's going to forget her. Should call it. It's true.
Yes, I always used to think that about those estates in like Protestant Belfast and that up the Shankill Road, where they paint red, white, and blue on the paving stones. If she walks down here and all she sees is Union Jacks on all the windows and all the roofs, what if she looks down for a minute? She'll go, "Ew, they don't like me at all."
Traitors. Did it a bit today with just like slightly similar. Talking about slavery and the Guardian's decision or revelation that they're built on, that the founder had heavy involvement in the slave trade, and all the people, which you can predict like clockwork, getting in touch to pretend that they've got relevant points to make about the Romans having enslaved the Welsh, or did they need to apologise? All these self-appointed geniuses. And then the Daily Mail position on it, which is always, well, why are we talking about this? It happened years and years ago. And you sort of think, well, that means we'll never mention Winston Churchill again, doesn't it? Because if that's going to be the benchmark, we'll never mention the Second World War or the First World War or the bloody Empire. Because if we're not talking about stuff that is embarrassing or shaming for the nation because it is so long ago, then you can't really talk about the stuff that you think you're proud of. So it would work quite well in that context.
Now they're making us wear a poppy.
Yeah.
Yes, well, I do a joke about it on my show where I say, do you know what? This is terrible. I can't remember now if this is true or not. But I think it might be. But what is true, the start of it is true, that Katie Hopkins put on social media, "I called my daughter Poppy, so I'll remember. Will you?" So, and I did, I think it's true. I did reply to her. It was coming up to Poppy. I replied to her, "I agree. That's why I've got 3 kids and I called them Mud, Trench and Mustard Gas." It's the sort of...
Yeah.
It's also, The lack of logic of it is
it's performative, very... isn't it? It's always, so much of it is before, and you're not supposed to stop and think. This is the thing. As I get older, I get more frustrated by the invitation to turn your brain off and just to start hurling stuff. That's nonsense, isn't it? My favourite. I got a tweet off her once that said, "I'm coming for your job." That's worked out well for her.
Mind you, I think she's pretty mercenary, though, James. I think she'd do. I think if she'd take a 6-month crash course in,
she had a go. She had a go at doing it on LBC.
Oh, did she?
Yeah, they gave her a run out. It was an interesting period when I was on the roster with Hopkins, Farage, quite a few other people, not as toxic as them. I did somewhat stick out on that schedule. It's changed now. It's almost the other way around.
If it was like a normal job, yeah. Oh blimey, I've got to take the kids to the dentist tomorrow. Katie, can you stand in for me?
Yeah,
can you cover for me shift tomorrow?
I think she did. I think she did my shift on one occasion. And you're always walking a bit of a tightrope, so things have gone a bit nuts for me, say in the last 5 or 6 years. But before that, you're always conscious of being. Hey, we're all dispensable, but I wouldn't have kicked up a fuss about that at one point because I would have not wanted to kick up a fuss. So you do end up in some strange. I think she did my holiday cover once, and I may actually have. I think I did say, "Can we not do that again? Can we find someone less controversial, like maybe Pol Pot?"
So your EDL person would have been would have rung up.
Great, and, yeah, that's probably how he, that's probably up how he going, got hooked in.
Yeah. You're worse than me, darling.
In the first place. Your voice has gone a bit
funny. All I want is for him to be sent home, but you've gone way further, love. Sorry.
Sliced and diced.
I don't know how familiar you are with this podcast, James, but we have someone who comes on here, Mike Concrete.
Oh, yes.
And he gently teases out opinions, and he's learned a lot from you, I think.
Good. It's something like that.
I was going to ask you something else. Yes, so, now this is probably the stupid question that is the equivalent of what, when people say to comics, how did you get started then? And I always make something up because it's just not interesting.
How did you get started? How did you? Did you go activism to comedian or did you?
No, I was always a comic first.
Were you?
Yeah. Because I always make something up, so I just say whatever comes to my head after, you know. I used to work for a greengrocer company.
Is that true?
No, I'm just making it up.
I think you told me that when I interviewed you.
People believed it. It started off when I was on midweek with Libby Purvis.
Yeah.
And the researcher rang me up a couple of days before and she said, how did you get started in comedy? And I said, it's really not interesting. Please let's not talk about that. And she said, well, you know, it will be interesting. I said, well, only if I make something up. So she said, well, go. And I said, oh, all right. I said, well, my dad was a Polish diplomat. And every year I used to go with him to Katowice or Gdańsk or something. And I didn't know any Polish. And the only Polish I did know was a couple of Polish jokes, because that's the easiest way to learn Polish is the jokes. So one Christmas, he made a speech and then they all insisted I got up and said a couple of words in this great big vodka factory. So I got up and said a couple of jokes and they went really, really well. And word got out and I got booked to do a regular slot in a comedy club in Warsaw. And I thought, so now how many holes are there in that story? So I just said, really? I said, no, I'm making it up. And then 2 days later, I was on midweek with Libby Purvis live on Wednesday morning or something. And she said, now, Mark Steele, now you had a rather exotic beginning to your career, didn't you? I said, did I? Oh, Mark's being rather humble. His father was a Polish diplomat. Stop. And it all went out. So now there are people, and it's all of it. I think it was on Wikipedia at one point. Yeah, I've made all sorts of things up. Well, I said to one of them, I just think, well, you can't believe this. I said, I always wanted to play football, and I played football for Bexley Heath in the Kent League. But I was terrible, really. But I used to be really good at telling jokes at half time, and it had really spurred the team on. And so I got dropped from the team, but they kept me in the squad just so I could tell jokes. And one week, the jokes inspired people so much, the team was 3-0 down at half-time and won 4-3. And that got printed in the some Bexley Gazette or something.
Sensational. Sensational.
But anyway, it's just boring. I just wanted to do it, and I rang up some theatres. Anyway, so what's... But even more exotic is that to become a... because you haven't done it. You're obviously a journalist and so on. But
yeah.
At what not for point? What point did you think I'm the person who can sit there for 3 hours discussing things with people?
I never did. So my dad was a newspaper journalist. I wanted to be like him, but I couldn't.
What papers was he writing for?
He finished his career on the Telegraph. I mean, which was a very different newspaper to what it is now. He got made redundant during my last year at public school, and I didn't realise until he died what a blow that must have been, because they would finally have had some money for themselves. You know, there's so much money went on my school fees that I hadn't really appreciated it. I never really got the chance to have that conversation with him. But anyway, that's by the by. He had a good job on the Telegraph, and was the Midlands correspondent, so he did all the industry, all the stuff like that. I never really thought much about it. I just wanted to be a journalist, like lots of people want to follow their dads into the diplomatic corps or the greengrocer trade or whatever it may be. And it wasn't happening. I was never going to be a good news journalist. Because I get too shy, I get too nervous around people. I got turned down for every traineeship going. I finally flogged a suit to John Major, a white suit. To John Major, I was working in menswear at the time when he was on Spitting Image with grey skin and everything. So I knew that was worth a lead in the William Hickey column at the time, or the Ross Benson column, I think it was.
When he was Prime Minister?
Yeah, when he was Prime Minister, all the tailors were off sick at the shop where I worked. So me and another lad got sort of charged with kitting out John Major, and he bought something navy blue. And then at the end of it, he had an EU summit coming up in Florence. And he just said, I fancy something a little bit different. And so we sort of go through the swatches of cloth, and he picks a white suit. It was incredible, really. So I phoned up the Express Gossip column. I had a mate who was working on it. He didn't really want me to get shifts because he wanted me just to give him the stories. You see what I mean? So I'd be a source for him, whereas I was desperate to get into journalism, and it was beginning to disappear over the horizon. They bought that off me, and instead of giving me cash, I said, can I have a couple of shifts? Did a couple of shifts. I was very, very bad, but I just squeaked over the wire to getting on the roster regularly, and I got better and better and better at it. I became showbiz editor quite quickly. Didn't enjoy it. I was drinking too much. It should have been great. I was going to film premieres, all of that. But I was just oddly unfulfilled and unsatisfied. And then Channel 5 were launching a show, a daytime show, which Matthew Wright was helming, who I knew from the showbiz journalism beat, and just out of nowhere, they just came along and said, do you fancy doing this? At the time, it would have been in conjunction. We'd have done the TV show in the morning and then gone back to our day jobs in the afternoon or the rest of the day. But then they decided they were going to film it in Norwich. So we had to choose between the newspaper jobs and the TV job. And I just fancied it. I'd recently got married. My wife is an amazing woman who gives me confidence to do things I wouldn't have had the confidence to do otherwise. And she said, look, you're not happy. You thought you'd be happy when you got to editor level. You're not. You'd probably be really good at this. I'd obviously done a lot of other TV shows, having an argument about the death penalty with Peter Hitchens that slightly unsatisfying circuit. And then we just launched the Right Stuff in Norwich. Did that for about 18 months. That petered out, moved back to London. They changed the format. I kind of got squeezed out of that. I didn't know what I was going to do. And again, I said to my wife, I'm going to have to go back to newspapers. And she said, well, give yourself a chance. I realize now, she was being very diplomatic when she said, you're very good at broadcasting. I said, I'm going to have to go back to newspapers. She said, but you're very good at broadcasting. I thought, I realize now what the subtext of that was, which was that I wasn't very good at getting stories. I can write. And then I just floated around for about 6 months doing paper reviews, didn't have kids, you know, mortgage wasn't huge. She was working. We were fine. And then I'll tell you what happened. I was doing Channel 5 News when Kirsty was doing it. And they had that format where you'd sit on a bench, and Kirsty had leaned back, and they'd have two guests on to talk about the news. It was about half of the bulletin. It was a nice little slot that you could stretch your legs a bit. Sometimes you're very constricted. And David Mellor had been booked as the other guest, but it was during the football, it was during the World Cup, and he got pissed and didn't turn up. And they couldn't, I presume he was pissed. He certainly didn't turn up, and he didn't apologize. They're trying to ring him and he's not picking up his phone. And so they bring up a lovely woman called Sandy Waugh, who worked for LBC, which was in the basement at Gray's Inn Road where ITN was based. Yeah, yeah. So you had all the TV stay. And she was sort of on a sort of permanent standby because she did the drive time show, which meant she would definitely be in the building every day and she'd definitely be available. So in case of emergencies, break glass. And Sandy would come and fill whatever slot the guest hadn't turned up or had, you know, got stuck in the lift or whatever it was. And we got on well. I liked her a lot. We had a good chat on air and off. And she just said, have you ever done any radio? And I said, not really. I only as a guest. And she goes, well, I'm off on holiday next week and my holiday cover's just fallen through. And you should phone my program controller. And again, I was one of those people. I'd ring numbers on the old-fashioned phones and then slam it down. I was always so nervous. I used to ring the speaking clock when I was on the gossip columns. The boss would say, could you give so-and-so a ring and ask them if they know about X, Y, and Z? And I'd go, yeah, I'll do that, certainly. The third stroke, the time sponsored by Accurist will be... No comment, John. No comment on that, I'm afraid. Okay, just...
Asked about the recent possible cabinet split, the Home Secretary said, the Times sponsored by Accurist.
That could have come through after lunch. That would have been great. So I just got nervous, but for some reason I made that call and they got me in and I never really left. I had quite a big tax bill to pay because I'd lost the TV job, and you always think you're going to earn next year what you earned last year, don't you? You never think that there's going to be a big... pothole. So I went in, I did all the weird shifts. It got bought by another company. I didn't get a slot. And then they phoned me up just before launch. I said, oh, terribly sorry, I forgot. We want you to do Sunday night. So I went in and did Sunday night. 6 months later, Weekend Breakfast. And then 6 months after that, where I am now.
This is doing the sort of thing you're doing now with people ringing up and going, yeah, oh, James, first time caller.
All of that, long time listener.
I've been down to our own base. Exactly, geraniums. That. What's going on, mate?
Sunday night was tough. I mean, the first one I ever did, no one rang. And it hadn't been a phone-in show before. It had been Pete Murray. Do you remember Pete Murray?
Oh, Pete Murray, bless him. Yes, he was on Radio 2 in the morning.
He'd been everywhere. Great broadcaster. But he did his own show in that slot, which didn't involve taking phone calls. And listeners are creatures of habit. So you can't just turn up and say, right, it's a phone-in show now, and everyone rings you. So it's 10 o'clock Sunday night, and I get to I'm setting out my stall. And I'd done it before. As a swing presenter in you know, filling in the gaps as they were slowly rebuilding the schedule after the company was sold. They sacked someone, and that means I'd got a fortnight's work filling in for them and desperately hoping that I was going to get a permanent gig. So, but this was my first time with my name above the door, the first time in the actual schedule, and no one rang. I mean no one, because, you know, you can see the numbers, you can see the phone lines light up, and there are some that might have warnings on them, say only in emergency or rings every day, but there was nothing, absolutely nothing. 10:15, 10:30, 10:45, 11 o'clock, we've done a full hour and I haven't had a single phone call. And I'm talking, and I'm good at talking, but crikey, there's a limit to how many...
To text someone and go, ring us up, mate.
Well, I wasn't thinking straight.
I'd do it if you ever stuck. I'd love to do it.
This is what happened. It doesn't happen anymore, mate. I mean, come on. And I see this, finally it flashes up, and I think, I know that number. This is back to, you know, 20 years ago, so you'd actually still be able to know numbers off by heart. Mm. And it was my wife, and she rang in with a fake name. And she'd realised, she'd clocked what had happened and came in, and it caught, kind of broke the seal. Well, it didn't break the seal immediately.
What did she say? Where did she pretend to be? She was
in the same place. I think she called herself Miranda. From Kensal Rise or Queen's Park, Ladbroke Grove, we were living at the time. And she just was a good, competent caller. But then my best mate, who'd also been listening.
I'll just say that is about as sweet, romantic, right? A thing as I've ever heard.
Yeah. No, well,
like
she,
a beautiful,
you know,
short story.
Imagine if she hadn't. I'd still be there now. I'd still be there now, desperately stringing it out, trying to get some. And then my mate rang in, Luke, who's an actor. And for reasons that I've never asked him about, he decided to do it in a Northern Irish accent. So he started a full-on, hey, now, Brian Kai. And he starts off like that. And obviously two, three, and I keep him on for a lot longer than he was expecting because there's no other bugger waiting to talk to me. And halfway through, he just forgets. The Northern Irish accent just completely disappears and he resorts to his sort of Notting Hill twang, his estuarine Notting Hill twang. But those two, my wife and my good friend, they create that. Then people realised it was a phone in, and they started ringing in, and we got away with it. We got away with it.
Oh, brilliant! Oh no, do you think you get many fake ones? Like Peter Cook famously used to ring in and pretend to be a Norwegian fisherman, didn't he?
They were poetry, though, weren't they? That was Clive Bull, who is absolutely one of the legends of the medium. And those some of those calls from Peter Cook were things of absolute beauty. I think Dom Jolly's just done a documentary on him, or just done something looking back at those tapes and those. And he rang into a colleague the other day, actually pretending to be someone else. But no, you got pretty good antennae. The producers.
I'll tell you what, Jay, can we see? Right, let's try this out. So you're on, and I'm ringing in, and I'm going to be Dave from Chelmsford.
Yeah. Hi, Dave. What's on your mind?
Well, you know, I saw these. They're all wandering about, aren't they? They're everywhere.
Who's that then?
Hey, oh come on! Don't give me that. You know what I'm talking about. You're not allowed to say these days, are you?
I promise you're allowed to say it to me. What? I don't know who you're talking.
Oh, you know, all the people from who aren't from around here. They're just everywhere. I've seen four this morning. There was two round the back of the house, and then there was two in the park. And they might have been the same two twice, but I'm counting them as four.
How can you tell where they're from? But did you talk to them at all?
I couldn't talk to them. They're talking different words. They're not words I know. That's the trouble these days. Everywhere you go, there's people using words you don't know. You know, words are a stranger in their own country these days.
And why does this bother you so much? Did you want to talk to them? Are you?
I don't want to talk to them. I've got stuff to do. I've got boogies to go to. I've got paint to buy. We're supposed to be doing
And you can still do all of that. These corners of your community.
Not if they're talking to me in a foreign language. I don't know the Polish for paint.
But they're not putting a Polish fella in the bookies, are they? Who doesn't speak English?
Well, I don't know. Dave. But this is the thin end of the wedge. It starts off with them in the park, and the next thing, they don't blend in, do they?
What if they learn English?
Eh?
What if they learn
English? Well, we shouldn't let them learn English. You should speak, What's the point of that? They've got too many Zs. They won't do it properly.
There's a lot of Zs. Yeah. There's a lot of Zs. That's not far from one of the ones that actually happened quite early on. And this is when I actually started changing my approach slightly. It was John in Hounslow, it was. And he said what you just said. He said you can't say what you want without being called racist. And I said, well, I won't call you racist. I promise I won't call you racist. And he said, I said, what do you want to say? And he said, there are too many Pakistanis in Hounslow. And I thought, Christ. I mean, that's quite a moment on the radio because it's obviously a racist thing to say. And it's uncomfortable and you're live. But I've made this little pledge that we're not going to cut him off. And I said, what's wrong with that? Why is that a problem for you? Just like I just did with you. And he says, well, they smell. And I'm like, okay, John. And remember, it's a bit like being on stage for you. You're in the moment and you don't know what. Sometimes it just works. It just the right words come. So I said, what do they smell of? And there's a pause, and he went, curry. And there's another pause, and I'm thinking, it's when you're in full speed and slow motion at the same time, mentally. I said, and do you like curry, John? There's another pause. Yeah, I do. Curry. And I don't need to do anything else, do I? That's it.
All these people around here these days, they smell of a smell I like.
Yeah.
You do sort of wonder if at some point there he's gone, do you know what? You're right.
Yeah.
All these years.
Yeah. I know. It was like when Farage came on and he'd been doing his shtick about people talking foreign on trains.
Yes.
See, we've done that thing. We've both done, and it's more of a stretch for me than it is for you, but we've both done an accent then when we're doing these callers. And that's actually a mistake.
Yes, because, it's unfair, yeah.
Yeah, because Farage, is just sort of pound shop public schoolboy, and he spouts exactly the same crap. He just says it in a different accent. Yeah, so he's just done his shtick about people speaking foreign on trains, and he ends up in the studio. It's quite a convoluted story how he ended up there. But I point out to him that his children probably speak German to his wife at home, given the fact that they're half German and she's German and she's. And you can see that thing. It's like saying, what do they smell of? And he just goes, I don't imagine they do it on trains. And you just, what? they speak foreign to each other all the time, but not on a train. It was actually the train. It was the train that offended your sensibilities, not the actual
Yes.
Deployment of foreign languages. And so, usually these balloons, quite easy to pop.
There's a thing I was thinking, because, yes, well, I've got exact words, but it was something like, I was on a train the other day and I heard three people speaking a foreign language. It did make me feel rather uncomfortable.
That's
mental illness. If you hear a foreign language and you go, that's like being one of these people who's scared of buttons. You need to go and see someone.
Yes, it is.
There is one, and I must talk about this because I know we've talked about this before, but it actually made me howl. And it's not because I didn't like the bloke. I actually did. I thought he came over quite well in a funny sort of way. And my memory of it is, tell me if you remember this, you said, right, what's your problem with the, you know, he was complaining about all the rules. And it was after the referendum and the Brexit and the negotiations and all that. And he said, I'll tell you what we should do, right, if they cut it with the French, right, I'm doing the act, but I think he did sort of like this, with these French, right, they're all mucking up and, I don't know, saying fish or whatever it is they're talking about, right, and all that, I don't know, bits of biscuit or whatever it is. Right, I'll tell you what, right, we symbol, what we do is we just say to the French, you can't come in here no more, that's it, you can't come in, that's the end of it, right, we're not allowing you in, you come by boat, you can't, you've got to go straight back, that's it, that'll sort it. And you said, as I remember, yeah, but then they do the same to us and say, you can't go to France. And he went. Now, I thought about that, James, and the thing is, I don't want to go to France. I think you've got him there.
He's got me back to right. This is perfectly reciprocal.
There was another one.
I don't want to go to France.
But there was another one who was complaining. Do you remember this guy? I just thought it was brilliant. He was complaining about all the rules, and you were doing that thing. Go, name one of the rules. Name one of the rules. All different.
I should only ever have got away with that once or twice, right? You'd have thought by then you're not going to get... Because it's like, you could see it from about 100 bloody miles away.
They're used to saying it, aren't they, in the past?
2017 or 2018, I've done it 100 times. I'm doing it every day. I'm doing it several times a week. It's the rules. Okay, could you just run me through all of them?
Yeah.
All of them. Go on.
Well, this one particular bloke, his rules were, right, all right, all right, all of them. And then you say, which one? Yeah. You know what I'm talking about. All that. And then he went, well, the sockets. The sockets, right, they've got different sockets from us. I don't like their sockets. And I think you made the perfectly reasonable point that you only get their sockets in Europe, you don't have them here, so you don't have to use their sockets unless you go over there.
It's incredible. But... I think he thought that they were going to make us change our sockets.
Yeah. Well, we're maybe they would have done if we'd stayed in. You don't know.
Almost certainly. Shows what you know, doesn't it? But that casting around for something to hang his hat on and coming up with that. There was another one. There was a woman who ended up talking to me about how she wanted to be able to wrap her fish and chips in newspaper again. And that was it. That was after a 5-minute kind of polite suggestion that she didn't have a bloody clue. We end up with her saying, and you're not allowed to wrap your fish and chips in newspaper anymore. I said, well, that's not because of, I mean, even if it is because of the, it's probably quite a good idea not to wrap your dinner in manky old bits of paper that have been passed around the doctor's waiting room anyway.
And even if they did allow it, it would have to be one of them broadsheet newspapers. I want to wrap it up in the sun. At the same time, and probably anyone listening to all this would not think this at all, but I do think that when I'm talking to someone like that, and you always do it professionally, but I sort of feel I'm with them in a way, unless they're absolutely rank. I do sort of think, now I understand where you're coming from, because I was from a background full of people. And I remember sitting in the pub and how exasperating it was having to deal with nonsense arguments. In your book, there's two of the chapters that I think are brilliant. Is one about just sort of the basic, about anti-gay feeling.
Yeah.
And the people who ring in, particularly people who ring in and start quoting the Bible. And
I do enjoy that.
You're then able to quote the Bible, Leviticus and so on, back to them. And of course it does. But I love that, I love that film Inherit the Wind about the with Spencer Tracy, and he's the liberal lawyer who in court fights against a guy called Stopes, and Stopes is a creationist. And in the early years of the 20th century, he took the whatever the equivalent of the Board of Education is in his particular state to court, because he's only creationism should be taught.
Yeah.
And Spencer Tracy plays the liberal lawyer who defeats him by using all sorts of biblical argument. Where does the light come from on the day one if the sun was only invented after that and all that sort of thing? But the film's quite sympathetic to the guy Stopes. He's someone who passionately believes this, and he just can't let it go. A bit like an old Communist Party member or something who can't quite believe that the Soviet Union was a foul tyranny or something like that. And I don't know if it's a thing about getting old. I quite almost admire these people, unless they're being absolutely horrible.
No, well, it's authenticity that you've described. He genuinely believes that, and it helps him make sense of, you know, Hobbes said that life is nasty, brutish, and short. So these things that we cling to persuade ourselves that we're not just bits of flotsam and jetsam being tossed on the oceans of fate, whether it's religion or whether it's a hatred. A hatred can help you rationalize the world, make sense of the world. That's good and that's bad. And people cling to it. People derive identity from it. They derive confidence from it. So when it's authentic, it can be sympathetic, as you say, because they mean it. And then factor in also something I feel very strongly about, the effort that's put into pushing people into these positions. So with that example, it would be, you know, 2,000 years of Judeo-Christian doctrine. It's not exactly a miracle that someone's ended up betting their house on it all being true. People went to the stake in this country 300 or 400 years ago because they had a different flavor of Christianity from the one that was sending people to the stake 10 years previously when the current queen's sister was on the throne. So there's always, I mean, this depth of devotion should be respected and sympathized with. And then you get the papers telling people all this stuff. So I always think, and I think the answer to this question sums up what you're saying. Who's worse? You see the Fox News stuff this week, last week, where it turns out, I mean, surprise, surprise, they knew it was bollocks. They all knew, all of the presenters going on air are privately swapping messages about what a tosspot Donald Trump is and how insane it is that he's pretending he won the election. They are a million times worse for me than the idiots who believe it, if you see what I mean. Someone who actually believes it and is, you know, out to lunch, but genuinely believes it. And then you've got someone stoking up the hatred, disseminating the ignorance, fomenting the division for shits and giggles, for money or status or power. And it was when Murdoch said in one of those messages, "We're not red or blue, we're green," that I just thought, that's it. So that's what you're talking about. The people who do actually, it helps hold them together in a way, these beliefs that we might find fairly toxic or unpleasant. They're authentic, as opposed to the people doing it for money. You know?
So you end up being quite sympathetic. It's hard to tell the difference.
Yes.
I've just got now, before we run out of time, just two tiny little subjects just to clear up. Brexit and adoption. Mm. Now.
Okay. Yeah, just little things. Little triviality.
With Brexit, and this is, you know, again, come back to the fact that I sort of think you have to be sympathetic to people who, if you're a Remainer, as both of us very much were. I think you have to be sympathetic. First of all, because when the campaign was being run for a second referendum, there were a number of people I saw on the Remain side who were so vitriolic about anyone who'd voted Leave. And I think I did challenge one of them on social media. And I said, I think, you know, we have to try and win an argument with someone. And someone replied to me saying, as far as I'm concerned, anyone who voted Leave is an idiot and I don't want to speak to them. And then I did say, well, then what's the point of a second referendum? Because you're obviously not going to win any one round then, are you? Right, thank God we've got our second referendum. I went up to people and told them that they're
idiots
a stupid, fucking, moronic, swat-faced pile of spunk. And they...
Yes, it's a very good point. We started in a way.
Yes, and I think that if supposing there was a referendum right now, I think I personally would be able to argue it far better than I would at the time, which was barely at all. Basically, I just thought the people I like are mostly on the Remain side, and the people I don't like are mostly on the Brexit side. That will do me. And now I think, oh, right, no, there are a load of really, really good reasons. I didn't know it. So I think that the Remain campaign was rubbish.
Yes. But it was so unbalanced, wasn't it? Because the Remain campaign was largely evidence-based, but the mistake they made was constantly saying this really, really bad stuff is going to happen, not this really, really good stuff is going to stop happening. So, you know, it was disastrous. But the problem was, Mark, they'd deny it. So you'd say, and I'm exactly the same as you, I wasn't qualified to vote in that referendum. And the catchphrase I had immediately after was always contempt for the con men, compassion for the con. But you're right, loads of people missed the distinction between the con men and they conned, and they were conned. And that is also obviously insulting. No one likes to be told that they've been conned. But they didn't. You would say, of course, we're not going to be able to trade in the single market. David Davis saying we'll be in Berlin the day after the vote. They need us more than we need them. You can't argue with that. You can't argue with that. You can't say no. Well, you can. You can say no, we don't, and they'll say yes, they do, and you'd say no, we don't. It's a stupid bloody argument. And then you'd say something like, so this is where the exceptionalism kicked in. Not a particularly xenophobic exceptionalism, but an intellectual exceptionalism. They couldn't conceive of the possibility that we would be a third country just like Turkey. They couldn't conceive of the possibility that England in particular, not just the United Kingdom, but England would be so diluted that surely we're allowed to use the analogy that was popular at the time. We can give up our membership and carry on using the gym. Don't be ridiculous. We're British. No one's going to keep us out of this gym. We bloody built it. And that's where it went wrong. They lost. They didn't successfully explain that we would lose all of our privileges. And also, for two decades, no one had ever explained we've actually got a better deal than anybody else. If you care about keeping your own currency and you care about rebates and you care about opt-outs, it drives some of the French and German politicians potty what has been secured for the Brits over the years in order to assuage the Eurosceptics.
One of the great ironies could be that in 20 years, we beg to go back in and then we're allowed back in the EU, but without any of them privileges. So we end up being told what to do in the way that Farage said was happening when it wasn't. I mean, there's so many things. I'm on tour at the moment, and I've got a brilliant tour manager, Nick, and he does bands mostly. And he was just explaining the extraordinary length of administration he has to go to now to get a band out into Europe, including things like they're only allowed to go to three separate places, right? So if you go to Munich and then Cologne and then Stuttgart, you then have to come back and go back out there again and all manner of things that I can't understand. And all of
that. Every drumstick has its own paperwork. Yeah.
Every drumstick has exactly what he was telling me. And of course, one of the big selling points of Leave was at last we will get rid of red tape. And I know. Really, they were complaining.
See, I mean, it is surreal now. Yeah, it is. It is surreal, and you know, it's 2020 hindsight's a wonderful thing, but it's very hard to find anybody who. It's why sovereignty became such a watchword so quickly, because people realised pretty quickly that none of the promises they'd made or believed were going to be kept, and you know what happens next, God only knows. There's a great line from one of the European Union politicians recently talking about how we used to have loads of opt outs. And we were members, and now we're not members. We want to have loads of opt-ins, and the first one was possible, but the second one just isn't. There's no sort of loyalty card just because we used to be in the middle of it, and it's not even started yet. You're going to get this summer's going to be interesting. The queues at just little things like passport control, food coming in, all that kind of thing. It's so.
Well, now they go. They're just being vindictive now, aren't they? They're just being vindictive. That's what
they will say that. Yeah, they're being vindictive by treating us like non-members of the European Union. Why are they treating us like we're not members of the European? Because we're not members of the European. Didn't mean it.
I went down a snooker club. I left about 6 weeks ago. I don't pay my membership no more. I went down, started playing. They said you can't. Nothing. They won't let me have the chalk, the balls, the cue. Nothing. Fucking vindictive. That's what that is. So lastly, minor subject, I hope we've got 2 minutes to talk about this. So something we share is that we were both adopted, James. And so and you traced your people who gave birth to you? Or you tried?
Not really. I did it by accident during lockdown. I was applying for my Irish passport to knit these two subjects together with particular ease and grace.
Let me do a proper segue there, like I'm professional. Now, one of the things, of course, if you are someone who's had to go through the iniquities of Brexit, is that one of the ways out of it has been to try and get an Irish passport. How did you come across your particular Irish passport? How did you attempt to solve this conundrum, James?
It's very funny you should mention that, because I know you're also keen to talk about adoption, and it was when I was applying for my Irish passport that I got all the paperwork out of my mum's loft that I hadn't really seen, like my original birth certificate with my birth name on it rather than my actual name, my adopted name. And I got all the paperwork out of my mum's loft, and I had my biological grandmother's name on my biological mother's birth certificate, all of which I needed to prove my Irishness to get my passport. So I just Googled it. I was sitting on the sofa in the kitchen. I remember it. I was a bit bored. I'd had a wine. I just thought, well, this will be fun, because it was quite a, it wasn't like, you know, Rosie O'Flaherty or something like that. It was a name that looked, it was all three names. The middle name was quite rare. I can't remember it. And even if I could, I wouldn't bloody say it now, would I? And I typed it in, and up she popped. Her funeral notice popped up on the screen, and that was it. And I looked at who'd attended the funeral, and there was the name of her children. And there was my biological mother in the middle of it. Had the same sort of corner of Ireland that they'd been in when I was conceived, and there it was. I found her on Facebook about 5 minutes later, and that was enough. She's happy. She's got a family. I always had that fear that, you know, her life had gone awful after giving up her baby, but she had her own children now. So it killed it stone dead, really. The lifelong mild curiosity just went. So I had no I haven't really thought about it much since, except when I'm asked about it. Whereas previously, if there was one of those Nikki Campbell shows on the telly, or when I interviewed you the first time, not the first time we met, the first time we had a proper chat, it would have been very much in the forefront of my mind. But bizarrely, it just isn't anymore. Just kind of almost.
It's funny, isn't it, that it is less. I mean, my story is so utterly ridiculous. My natural aunt, she came yesterday, for example, to the show, and now we get on. I get on fine with them, but it's not my natural mother. Died, I never met her. And it's, to other people, it's a bigger thing. It's like, wow, yeah, don't usually. You want to know? Don't you want to know? Don't you want to know more? And, yeah, sort of.
You can see why, because it's an idol moment. Alien. It's, yeah, exactly. So, and for some people, it's huge, isn't it? I'm sure we both know people that have had an overarching need to find out more about their origins. I don't think there are any simple explanations of the difference, but I'm like you, it was more mild curiosity and conscious of not wanting to go off in somebody else's family like a hand grenade. You don't know what you know, who she's married to now may not even know I exist. They don't want to suddenly turn up and go, surprise. God knows what sort of ramifications that should have, but it's quite secure about things.
My natural half sister is a supermodel who went out with Liam from One Direction and is currently doing art in London.
Are you serious? Because this could be another bloody Polish diplomat moment, couldn't it?
So it's not.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Wow. She's, are you in touch with her?
No. It not would at take all. One moment, wouldn't it? It would take one. It would just take one little moment. And then he. So I've been in touch with him. I've met him, the natural father, who, for all I know, subscribes to this podcast. I doubt it. He lives in Los Angeles in a house that's worth $40 million that replaced the one that he bought off Luther Vandross.
Yes. Now, this is all true. You've mentioned some of this to me before, which, of course, makes all your fibs even more effective.
I know. I couldn't make up it. I know. The Polish diplomat story ends up being far, far less exactly. exotic than the
exactly
truth.
Exactly that. Yes, exactly that. It's not even in the top five.
Yeah.
Love it.
So, yes, bless her. So, if you're listening, Cairo, get in touch. I'll tell you what, you don't have to subscribe. You can have the first month for a pound off. James, it's been absolutely delightful speaking to you. And
Thank you, Mark.
We will again very soon, but we won't.
Definitely.
We absolutely will.
Love it.
And
thank you
so much for it. And also How to Be Right, and what else should we be sort of telling people about? How to Be Right in the bookshops.
How to Be Right, How Not to Be Wrong. I'm working on the new one now, but that's still a way off. I think it's going to be called How They Broke Britain. But there's a lot of material.
You know, one thing I'd love to do one day is I'll ask Mike Concrete if he's up for interviewing you.
Do it. Clash of the Titan.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, mate. What the fuck is going on?
Thank you so much for listening to this podcast. If you've liked it, rate it, and if you can be bothered, write a review. If you can't be bothered, definitely write a review. If there is anything at all that you think I should be finding out what the fuck is going on with it, please send me a message on Twitter at WTFisGoingOnPod, and we will look at every message that you send. If you would like to become a WTF supporter for as little as £2 a month and get early access to ad-free and extended versions, please visit our Patreon page. What the fuck is going on? Was hosted by me, Mark Steele. The music was by Willie Dowling. It was produced by Mike Benwell and Pete Sinclair at Carousel Studios. And What the Fuck Is Going On was brought to you by WTF Productions.